So this I have gone through all this. Then we were asking the question, how did the various constituents of the cloud that evolved into the solar system get formed? That is the question that... This is a very difficult question, and this is where the whole field of astronomy, particle physics, everything comes into the picture. So far it was probably just extension of... Pardon? Yeah, ocean is the following. The question is, in the chemistry of the earth, what happens is you produce lot of crystals. And it is the water of crystallization that comes out. Finally, that fills the oceans essentially. There is no synthesis of water outside. What happens is the water is synthesized as form of in the crystals. Various crystals are formed inside in the chemistry of the earth. And that water comes out. And that is what makes the ocean. I have not gone into very great details because I thought I had to, in 1 hour to cover what happened in 20 billion years is... Now, we have to expand our horizons. We were just talking about the sun and the earth and the planetary system. Now, to answer the question, how did we get this material out of which the solar system was formed? We had to understand that we are just one, the sun is just one star out of 100 billion such stars in one system which we call the Milky Way. In fact, I have a few slides, but I don't know if you have a projector. I can show it at the end. See, we have something like 100 billion stars in what we call the Milky Way galaxy, and the star is one such. Our sun is one such star in that 100 billion stars. So, the question is, the material as far as the sun is concerned must have come from the, again we shift the scene, that is, what, just as we said, for the earth it came from the sun, solar material system, the solar material has come from this entire system of the 100 billion stars. Now, these 100 billion stars, many of them, when you make the spectroscopic analysis, just contain hydrogen and helium. They don't contain, just like our sun also, much of other elements, but mostly hydrogen and helium. But compared to the sun, many of these are much hotter, the stars. So the temperature inside is much more than what we see even on the sun. The sun temperature in the core is very high, but in the stellar interiors, the temperature is still higher. Now, if you have hydrogen and helium, I make that assumption. Now we'll ask the question, how did I get hydrogen and helium? Then it turns out that I can cook all the elements I want in the stars. That means, again, it becomes a still higher temperature oven in which if I put hydrogen and helium and go on increasing the temperature, and if I have sufficiently high density, then out of that oven come out the various elements. I can produce first helium, then from helium there are alpha particles. From alpha particles combinations I can produce carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. Depending upon the temperature and density, it is possible to cook all the elements up to some value in the interior of stars. So what happens is that the elements that we see in the sun and correspondingly on the earth have all come, have all been cooked from in the stars out of hydrogen and helium. So the primordial substance out of which everything else has been cooked is hydrogen and helium. Now, of course, the time scale is enormous. You see, you know, to be able to do all this cooking, it doesn't take place in a day or 2 days or 100 years or 200 years. It goes into billions of years. The time scales are very large. But then another interesting thing happens. Now, how did something that get cooked in some star somewhere You see, come to us, because the distances between one star and another is huge. How did it happen? This is where we have to understand that these stars are not stable. They explode. You see, as the star is going through its burning phase, and as it goes on burning away, it's giving out the energy and goes on contracting, then it reaches a stage where it suddenly explodes and throws away all the material it has cooked into the interstellar space. And it gets, and that interstellar space gets filled with the elements that have been cooked by some of these stars. In fact, last year you must have read, 1987, there was a big one of the stellar explosions in our neighborhood galaxy called Large Magellanic Cloud. And even today, a lot of observations are going on that. The important thing is that many of these theories, that is cooking of elements at various temperatures, because I'm just telling you it happens, but you have got to prove that such elements are cooked. And that has been established very well, because people have been able to see the, for example, in the supernova 1987A, very recently, the last few months, observations have confirmed the cobalt-60 lines. That means cobalt-60 being cooked in the supernova after a certain phase has been established. And that is what one expected in such scenarios, elements like cobalt-60 should be cooked. In fact, we also have observations, such stellar explosions take place not only in our galaxy, but in our neighboring galaxies also, or in far-off galaxies. And even very, for example, I talked about just 92 elements. Actually, we don't stop there. You can, even in the laboratory, it has been possible to make, by collision using accelerators and high-energy particles, it has been possible to go and produce what we call trans-uranic elements, beyond uranium, which was the limit to the naturally occurring elements. So such trans-uranic elements, for example, californium-254 is one of the elements that has been recognized in stellar explosions in some of the, because the intensity is so high, the quantity produced is so large, that even from the Earth, by spectroscopic analysis, it is possible to recognize the, and also the, when you produce californium-254, it has got a typical decay rate. So you can establish the production of such elements very unambiguously. So there is a lot of support for the production of such elements. And we are waiting. Every time a supernova explosion takes place, people make spectroscopic observations in the various parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. You make X-ray observations, you make observations in the gamma rays, you make observations in the ultraviolet, you make observations in the infrared, to establish what kind of elements are there, what kind of phenomena are taking place in the lab. In fact, 1987A has become one of the most studied objects now because of this reason, because it is going to tell us when a star explodes, the sequence of things that happen around it. Supernova is just, if you take a star, you take a star like the Sun, then for some time, a star has got various layers of materials, hydrogen, helium, carbon, oxygen, and so on. I mean, I'm talking about a star which is a late type of star where it's not a primordial star just containing only, to start with, you only had stars which had hydrogen and helium. I'll come to that. But most of the stars that we see today have all the elements, because they have again come about out of that material that was there in the interstellar space. Now, these elements, for example, hydrogen being the latest, will be on the outermost of the star. Then comes helium, etc. So, space-wise also, the heavier elements will be on the inside, and then the lighter elements will be on the outside. Then what happens is, the star goes on, like our Sun, goes on radiating away, because when you have got because the very high temperature, various types of reaction takes place, and then energy goes on and all the hydrogen is depleted. Then there comes a stage when you do what is known as helium burning. So all the helium gets depleted. Then what happens is, then you go into the carbon burning phase. So as this goes on happening, a star itself is a huge mass of gas, and there is a equilibrium between gravitational force which is tending to pull it inside, and then the radiation which is pulling it outside. You see, it is trying to make all the matter go out, because the radiation pressure is trying to send everything out, whereas the gravitational pressure is trying to compress everything. So a star is in a dynamical, that's how the sun is also, a dynamical equilibrium of the two, the radiation pressure and the gravitational pressure. So here what is happening now, as time progresses, one by one you are removing the material. So gravitation is starting dominating now, because the radiation is becoming less and less, because the amount of material, nuclear fuel, is less. Because of that, so ultimately you reach a stage where the gravitation starts dominating over radiation. The whole thing collapses. When the whole thing collapses, it explodes. No, black hole is a different thing. If you want, I'll talk about it later. But a normal star just explodes. And then what happens is, to answer your question, when it explodes, it leaves a certain central thing, and then much of it, in fact, in one of the slides I will show you what happens to the material that comes out. It forms into what is called a huge nebula. The central thing, depending upon how much mass is left in the central object, you see, if that mass is larger than the famous Chandrasekhar limit, you see, 1.5 stellar masses, then, you see, it can form into what's called a neutron star. And if the central mass is more than about 3 to 4 stellar masses, what is left after the explosion, then it becomes a black hole. So we'll come to, if there is time, we'll talk about it, or during discussion we can talk about it. So, all these elements get cooked in the normal stars. Up to iron there is no problem at all, you can cook in the various interiors of stars. So the stars which got formed later, we have got the primordial stars which are just hydrogen and helium, because hydrogen and helium were cooked right in the beginning, I'll come to that. They contained all these elements, and it has been possible to now talk in terms of first generation stars and second generation stars, and second generation stars will have all these materials like silicon, magnesium, sulfur, and so on. And when they explode, they populate the interstellar space with this. So any new star formation that takes place already has the necessary material there. So now, yeah, in fact, I have talked about the 1987 supernova explosion where cobalt 56 was created, not 60, I'm sorry. So, it's very important to understand, if you ask a simple question, the iron in our blood, as the doctor will tell you, we have a lot of iron in our blood and there is a lot of calcium in our bones. From where did it come? It has come from some stellar explosions, or maybe a large number of stellar explosions that have taken place very far away, some billions of years in time. So in truth, as some of the astrophysicists say, we are children of the universe in every sense of the word, because each part of our body, if you analyze, it can be traced to something that has happened somewhere very far away from us in a very remote time. For example, if you ask, these are the typical examples that are given, the calcium and the iron. Now we ask the question, how did hydrogen and helium, the stuff out of which everything else is made, come into being? Okay, that is the crucial thing. Here, we go into an entirely different realm, and that is where lot of experiments that have taken place in the laboratory in the last 30-40 years have become very relevant. So let me just quickly go through this. We said the sun is just one star out of 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy itself is one among 100 billion galaxies which constitute the universe. That is our present idea of the universe. There are at least 100 billion galaxies, And each galaxy on the average has something like 100 billion stars. And our sun is one such star, and we are part of one such, one planet of such a star.
You talk about billion here, billion,
or it's one of those? No, we know the numbers. You can count. In fact, I will show you in some of the slides. You can do what is called Sali-Pollock. It means you take a part of the sky, then with the powerful telescopes, you are able to count the number of stars. And some of these telescopes have an extremely narrow angle. And in that, you can count the number of stars. Actually, on a clear night, if you go to a village site where there is no light, you can start counting something like 6,000 stars yourself.
10 to the power of 9.
Billion is 10 to the power of 9. We use the billion and the trillion. TEV, that is... So, as I say, I was talking about the constitution of the universe, because now we are going to talk in terms of how the hydrogen and helium got formed, so I have to talk about the universe itself. Then these 100 billion galaxies at least are there. Then the other most important thing is that this is all matter. What we see, it is the various stars, etc., are all lot of matter is there. But an important discovery was made about 20 years ago, not 1963, 25 years ago, that the universe is not filled only with matter, but with radiation. That radiation is not just the sum of all the radiation that we are getting from the stars, etc. That is one contribution. But much more dominant radiation is there, which fills every cubic millimeter of space, wherever you go in the universe. There's an enormous quantity of radiation, which is at a very, very low temperature radiation, which fills the entire universe. And this is a very important finding, because this is what gave clue to what is called the Big Bang creation of the universe. That this radiation that we see today is nothing other than what was produced in a big explosion that took place 20 billion years ago. And this radiation has, in fact, the two scientists who detected this radiation, Penzias and Wilson, were awarded Nobel Prize. That was the first Nobel Prize in astrophysics that was given, because it had such a tremendous importance to the whole understanding of everything that in this whole area of physics, astrophysics, everything. Because the realization that we are also, we just can't think only in terms of matter, but there is a relic radiation which we can trace back to 20 billion years. These radiation are not gamma rays. These radiation are extremely low energy microwave radiation. It's called actually 3-degree radiation. Everywhere uniformly spread. You see, what happens is, in the neighborhood of a source, you won't see it very much because that dominates. But if you go into the intergalactic space or interstellar space, this radiation dominates. And this radiation is completely isotropic. In fact, it's from the isotropy that we are able to say that it is universal. And it fills...
Yes?
Isotropic means it's the same in every direction. Whatever direction you see, it is the same. Pardon? Yeah, you know what happens is a radiation you express in terms of a temperature. See, for example, you get a certain number of photons of different energies depending upon a certain temperature. If I take the sun, typically we say the solar radiation has a temperature corresponding to 6,000 degrees. That is, the heat that we are getting and the light that we are getting is typical of a body. If you just a black body, if you heat it up to 6,000 degrees, that's the kind of radiation that gives. So in physicist parlance, you talk in terms of for every radiation that you see a certain temperature. This is a very, very cold radiation. That means it has very low energy photons. But that is filling the whole universe. Now the interesting thing, the consequence of this is that...
Yes.
No, that I'm telling you that it is completely isotropic. Wherever you go, you find it is identical, extremely isotropic, and therefore it has to be universal. You see, if anything, if it was not isotropic, then if you have preferential directions, then it is, you could not say it is universal. But because it is extremely isotropic, you come to the conclusion that it is universal. Now, another important development that took place in the beginning of this century, which is now, is that this entire system of 100 billion galaxies that I talked about as the universe is not static. Even the stars in our galaxy are not static. They are moving with respect to each other. But the galaxies themselves are expanding. This is a very crucial observation that was done by a man called Hubble, that when he started looking, and these big galaxies were just looking like patches of light. Even in the very big telescopes, when you see them, you are not able to resolve. Nowadays, there are very powerful instruments to resolve them. But during those days, he saw them as patches of light. But then he found that the larger the separation between the galaxies, the greater is the speed with which they are getting away from each other. It is similar to if you take a balloon and put a lot of dots on the balloon and blow it, then the dots separate out. And then, you see, this kind of expansion is such that each dot is moving away from the other. And imagine that there is a three-dimensional one in which the larger the separation, the greater the speed with which they are separating out. So somehow, this was a great mystery. Why? First of all, the galaxies are not trying to come together, but are trying to get away from each other. And why the larger the separation between the galaxies, the greater is the speed with which they are running away from each other. It turned out, this is the most fascinating thing, that when they measured those velocities, which became possible, you know, as I said, that the same spectral lines that you see in the laboratory of hydrogen, helium, etc., are also there in those distant objects. But if an object is moving away from you, then according to Einstein's relativity, what happens is there is what is known as the Doppler shift. That is, the spectral line changes its frequency. And by measuring the change in frequency, you are able to say that measure the velocity of the object even though it is so far. So on that basis, by measuring the shift in the spectral lines, he was able to come to this conclusion that the larger the separation, the larger the velocity with which they are going. Then somebody came with a very beautiful explanation that all the galaxies, everything that we see, were together at one point of time. The ones that I see, if you want to bring back the more distant ones and the nearer ones all together to one point of time and one point of space, then it must be that the ones that are away from each other must be moving with respect to each other much faster than the near ones. It fitted beautifully. It turned out that these velocities matched beautifully, the variation in the velocities as a function of distance, such that they could come to a very quantitative explanation of what is known as a universal expansion of the universe from one point of time and one point of space. You can't say which particular space point it is, because if you have a balloon and if it compresses, you know, each point is as good as any other, because we don't know, there is no particular preferred point in space. But that is started from one point. So the idea came that the entire universe was just all together at one point of space and time some 20 billion years ago. That's what this expansion, the universal expansion and the relative speed with the Hubble expansion is known as, gave rise to that idea. So this is the famous Big Bang creation theory, that if you go back in 20 million years ago, then there was a cosmic egg where all the matter was there. Now you can imagine, if I say that the universe is expanding today and I want to compress it, as I go back in time to that 20 billion years ago, it goes on compressing, 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 All the matter has to be compressed, all the radiation has to be compressed. So naturally the density of matter, for example, now it is something like 10 to the power of minus, very small, if you take all the matter and see what's the average density in it, negligible quantity. But you go to densities, I'll show you in the next thing, enormously high densities as you go back in time. So the idea came that all this came about from one cosmic egg that exploded. Of that cosmic egg had to be infinitesimal, because from there everything started, had to be of almost infinite density. Infinite density means infinite energy must have been there. Huh? Yeah, we'll come to that. That we will reserve to the end. That's the last question. No, 20 billion years as measured in terms of Earth years. You see, this is a very important question you raised. You know, time itself is a function of where you are and all that. But when we say 20 billion years, as we understand a year, and in terms of Earth years. So why did I bring that and creation of matter? You see, this is what we started with. We wanted to know how matter is created. Now the two I have to link up. Now, in the last 30-40 years, another development that has taken place is we have been able to create various kinds of particles in the laboratory by collisions. We have seen the creation of various types of particles, which we call fundamental particles. For example, I said that we have only three kinds of particles, protons, neutrons and electrons. But what has happened in the last 30-40 years is that we have discovered these are not the only particles, but there are a very large number of particles. But why they are not important for most purposes is because they don't live long. They are all extremely short-lived. But they are important, they are produced, but they don't live long. Now, some of the important things that were seen in laboratory experiments were, if you take the electron, which is the particle which is responsible for electric current in a wire, or which is the one that goes around the nuclei in the atomic orbits, if you accelerate an electron, it gives out a photon. So, and the higher the energy with which you accelerate the particle, the higher the energy of the photon that comes out. That was one of the creations that was seen. Then it was also seen that if you have a high energy photon, in the experimental detectors one could see two particles coming out of one radiation. That is, a photon comes in and produces a pair. That is what the philosophers would say, materialization of radiation. Radiation becomes matter. Because originally we started with two ideas, matter and radiation. Now we don't make that distinction, but still the photons, which are the light particles of much higher energy, they can get converted in the laboratory, we have seen, into electrons and positrons. The pair creation takes place. Then, if you go to still higher energies, you find if you take the collision of two particles, then you produce a large number of secondary particles. I'll show you in the slide how we have recorded this. There is one particle comes and collides with another particle, and in a time less than 10 to the power of minus 23 seconds, that's the time that you see suddenly a lot of new particles being created. So creation of particles became a reality, we could see, and in extremely short intervals of time. All that was necessary was to put in sufficient amount of energy into a small amount of space. If you put in a sufficient amount of energy into an extremely small amount of space, then what we thought was just empty space in that neighborhood, you could mine out all these particles. Just as we mine various elements from the mines, here, just by putting in sufficient amount of energy in an extremely small amount of space, it turned out conditions were enough to create various kinds of particles. That is precisely what was happening in the early universe now. You see, what I said was that as you go back in time, the universe was smaller and smaller and smaller. And as it was smaller and smaller and smaller, the temperature was higher and higher and higher. And what is temperature? Temperature is nothing other than the particle energies and the radiation energy being higher and higher. And the whole thing was compressed together. So it is just what you create in the laboratory, the conditions at accelerators or in the form of cosmic rays, that is precisely what happened there, that you had all radiation together, all particles together, and they were having enormously high energies because of the high temperature kind of.
But if this conversion is there, then did one at all postulate any density at the starting point? Because one would imagine that if it is only energy, maybe it doesn't need any density.
We'll come back to that starting point. But what happens now is, I hope you understand, that all we are trying to compress all the matter of the universe and thing. There is a certain amount of matter and radiation. If you go on compressing it, natural density has to go up, isn't it?
Yeah, but since you said that energy can be converted into matter.
Yeah. It is both. You see, I'm talking about you take it as combined energy density, energy and matter density, which is going up. You see, what happens is when you go back to these were early times, there is really no distinction between matter and energy. That's what it turns out. But what we can understand is, if you have to take the total universe of this 10 to the power of 56 centimeters dimension, go on, compress it, make it smaller and smaller, density has to go up and temperature goes up. So those are the conditions. It is just again a very high temperature crucible in which you have all the matter which is and all the radiation is there, and out of that laboratory experiments show when you have conditions like that, you start creating all types of particles. So the theory now is that you started with a very high temperature universe in extremely small amount of space, and then it started cooling, but in the very high temperature phase it created various types of particles. And these particles combined to form, in fact it turns out that these protons and neutrons which I talked about, according to our present understanding, are themselves made up of some other types of particles which are called quarks. They are not fundamental by themselves. Though for practical purposes, for all our chemistry and engineering, everything, we can stop with the protons and neutrons. Recent research has shown that these particles themselves are not the fundamental particles. There are still more fundamental particles which are given the very funny name quarks. And so the quarks combine together to form these particles. Just as the protons and neutrons combine together to form various nuclei, the quarks combine together to form the different types of particles that are seen to produce. So ultimately, according to the present day ideas, you have only two types of particles. There is quarks and leptons, that is the electrons and protons, things like that. And you make everything out of these particles at these very high temperatures. And these very high temperatures are available to you as you go back in time.
Yes, you are referring to the antimatter.
Yeah.
But the protons are traveling, they create electrons and protons.
Yeah.
So
what is the antimatter? Yeah, you see. Yeah, very good thing, question that you have asked. You see, for a long time, we thought, from our experience, we have only one type of matter. That is, we are familiar with the proton and the electron. If you take hydrogen, we recognize that it has got a positive nucleus and one electron going around it. Now, when theorists thought about this, they said, why should not the opposite happen? Why should there be not a negative particle in the center? After all, charge can be symmetric and you have a positive particle going around. What is it that made the universe as we see it, the earth, in such a way that wherever you see, you don't see a hydrogen in which it is the opposite? Because from outside there is absolutely no difference between, because it is neutral, absolutely no difference between a hydrogen atom containing a proton, positively charged particle, an electron going around it, and another in which you have an antiparticle, that is opposite charge particle, and a positive electron going around it. So theoreticians were convinced that such particles must be there, because otherwise theory would not survive at all. It turned out that when experiments were done, such particles were seen. One did find the positive particle corresponding to the proton, positive particle corresponding to the electron, and so on. So one of the important things that had to be explained, why the universe itself is essentially dominated by matter, and the other one was called antimatter. You see, when we say antimatter, for everything that you have here, a proton and an electron, if you have the opposite, you call it antimatter. You can have anti-hydrogen, you can have anti-helium, you can have anti... Whereas these particles have been seen to be produced in the laboratory, it turns out that in nature, it is not there. Or if it is there, as some people still believe, that some of the stars are completely antimatter stars. They are so far away that we can't distinguish between matter stars and antimatter stars. But one important thing of the antiparticle is, an antiparticle and a particle cannot coexist together. The moment an antiparticle comes near a particle, it just explodes into radiation. So much of the, in fact, in this scenario which I was telling you, in the early part of the universe, whenever antiparticles were produced, they collided with the particles and the whole thing became radiation. Okay? But then we still have to answer, there are two schools of thought still. Some people believe that matter and antimatter is equal, but it is distributed non-uniformly, so that we don't have, in this part of the universe that we are familiar with, we have only matter. In some other part it could be antimatter. Antimatter, yes. Anti-man, yeah. But anti-man is a different question. Or even man outside the universe, outside us, is a different question. We can talk about it later. So now, in fact, the success of some of these theories is a combination of what has been observed at various high energy accelerators and what is. One has been able to create at least conditions under which why matter dominates over antimatter. It's an extremely technical thing which I don't want to go into. But with these quark theories, it is possible to be able to understand why we have a matter dominated universe than antimatter dominated universe. Not only that, you see, it turns out that matter consists of these protons and neutrons, and then radiation consists of the photons, the particles of light. It turns out that the universe is today dominated in terms of numbers by the photons rather than by the protons and neutrons. That's called, that's another anomaly. That also is beautifully explained in the new theories of the Big Bang creation. So you take all these ideas of particle physics, go back in time, and then you have the necessary temperatures and the densities and so on, and then you are able to understand the creation of the various particles. You see here, you don't have to worry too much about the details, just to give you some idea. If you take a scale factor as 1 today, the average density of the universe is 10 to minus 30. What it means is, you have to say 1 over 10, 30 zeros actually, followed by extremely small density compared to even the so-called vacuum that we see in the laboratory. Then as you go back in time, if you compress it, the scale factor by 1500, then you go back in time from 2 billion years. This was the size of the universe. It was 1500 times smaller some 10 million years ago, 10 million years from the Big Bang. Then the temperature, this is what most important thing. I told you that today, everywhere the universe is filled with 3 degrees radiation. If you go back in time, the temperature of this radiation goes on increasing. So at that time, it was 4000 degrees. Then it goes to, if you go back in time, to 10 minutes after this Big Bang explosion, the temperature was 3 billion degrees. If you go back to 1 minute, it is 10 billion degrees. And then if you go to some fraction of a second, then it goes to 10,000 billion degrees. It doesn't stop there. We are able to go. And now, at these temperatures, using our laboratory knowledge of production of particles, we are able to say what exactly happened, what type of particles got created, and so on. Then, I can go back. You see, these are all minus 8 seconds, minus 14 seconds, minus 26 seconds. Temperature goes on to 10 to the power of 24 degrees, which is very, very high temperatures. But then, this is the most important thing. We can go up to 10 to the power of 32 degrees and a time of 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds. Beyond that, there is a screen. We just can't know what is happening before 10 to the power of minus 40. There's an extremely small time, but we can't go to zero. In fact, if you ask the question, as somebody said, how did the initial zero, what happened at zero, the answer is we don't know. There is a natural screen coming in. That natural screen is coming in not because of it's a limitation that is coming because of our own understanding of the various forces of nature. So what happens is, when you go to that interval of time, the gravitational force, which is one of the weakest forces which we can think of, becomes so dominant that we don't know how to deal with the gravitational force when you go to such small dimensions. We are already going to dimensions which are extremely small, and that is where we stop. There is a screen beyond which we cannot go. And that is how the knowledge is still imperfect, in the sense that, but once you somehow reconcile yourself to the idea that there was an infinite density and something happened, and from 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds later, today we are able to construct a beautiful scenario of the sequence of events and explain practically everything that we observe in terms of astronomical observations and the various things. And we have got a very good idea of what happened at various intervals of time, what particles were produced, and how the various elements got cooked, how hydrogen got formed, how helium got formed, and then the various other stories which later on happened. Two important things are that we have a screen at 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds. It's called the Planckian time, and you see, that is also connected with a very fundamental issue, which I don't want to go into, because we think that space is continuous. In the ultimate analysis, space is not continuous. There is a finiteness even about space. You cannot make space smaller than a certain 10 to the power of minus 33 centimeters or so. We think time is continuous. Time also becomes, you know, there's a unit for time, which is extremely small. So you have got to quantize all these things, and at the same time build a theory, which is known as the quantum theory of gravity, which we are not able to do today. And that is one of the challenges of the future, whether one will be able to go to zero and understand what really happened. But a very important thing that we have to recognize is that as the universe starts compressing, you see, as the radius of curvature of the universe becomes smaller and smaller, then Einstein's theory of general relativity about the whole space and time structure comes into force. And then there is an entirely new way of thinking that all this matter, radiation, everything else is nothing other than the distortion of space and time. So you don't, if you ask the question, where did you get all this? Space and time got created, and it's the curvature of space and time that has changed with time. And wherever you have particle, it's a certain amount of curvature and space and time. And then whatever effects you see are again effects of, so in the final analysis one reduces it, but that's highly theoretical. And it's not clear how many dimensions of space are required there. That is the main point. It is not necessarily the three-dimensional space that we are talking about. You see, there the dimensionality of the space comes into account. So there are very fundamental questions which are still confusing. But using the knowledge that one has gained in the laboratory accelerators today, one has been able to go almost very close to this Big Bang. This is one scenario that is now most popularly believed by most scientists. But there is another scenario. Some people still maintain, some of the astrophysicists, that the universe has always been like this. There is nothing like a creation. That's called the steady state theory. What happens is the universal expansion, they agree, but it's going to go on expanding forever and ever because it has been there forever and ever. And whatever drop in density, see, if it expands, then there's a drop in density. So once in a way, in a room like this, once in 100 years, you create matter out of, just as in the initial Big Bang, you created so much out of it. If you just create, you see, one atom of hydrogen per century in a room like this, you are able to understand what is happening. But against such theories, the crucial evidence of the 3-degree radiation, so they are not able to explain the universality of 3-degree radiation on the basis of the steady state theory. Until the 3-degree radiation discovery was done, the steady state theory was taken seriously. But now, the steady state theories come up with a good explanation for 3-degree radiation, then we will again have a different scenario. But at present, the most popular one is this so-called Big Bang creation.
When you say 3-degree radiation, does it mean that the interstellar stuff is 3-degree stuff?
Yeah. The entire universe as a whole, the temperature today is 3-degree. Yeah, that's right, yeah. In this whole thing, the fundamental thing is space and time got created together, and there is nothing outside. You see, as when you talk about expansion, it is space that is expanding. There is no space outside. It is space itself that is expanding. It's like the balloon that is expanding. It is the space that is expanding. That is why the various bodies that are stuck in the space are expanding. So there is no question of it is expanding into something. It is the whole. It's the whole the balloon expanding. Smaller. Yeah. That is how we have determined. Actually, one has been able to determine. You see, a limit. You see, what happens is the following: because of observational problem and the velocity of light being finite, you can see only up to a certain distance. See, at the present time, because this expansion has taken place, now you can only learn about those objects which are within a distance, so that the light from there has had the time to travel in this 20 billion years. That is what you now call the size of the observable universe. But the point is that the universe is there. But what I am trying to say is that, we are not expanding into something. The space itself is expanding. The concept of space now is such that matter and the space are tied together. You see. It is like a balloon surface, you know. You balloon, of course, we normally, as the space between the stars expand, what is really happening, as the dots expand, what is really happening is the entire membrane is expanding.
Even outside the balloon, sir, if you take the anatomy of balloon, yeah. Balloon is not expanding into some space now.
No, that is, when you talk about space, it's only an analogy, say, kind of. That's also a very good question. How long the universe will continue? You see, there are two or three different scenarios. In fact, I don't have the slides there. I'll tell you what happened. This is connected with the question that was asked about black holes. See, If the universe, today I say 10 to the power of minus 30 grams is the density. Now one doesn't know that density very accurately. If that density is higher than a certain minimum value, then the universe will go on expanding. You know, if the density is less than a certain value, the universe will go on expanding like that. But if the density is less than a certain value, then the universe will expand up to a point and then start contracting. That means the universe will, supposing you take the scenario and it goes on expanding, then what happens is that one by one all the stars die. Because, you know, all the radiation goes away, all the nuclear fuel runs away. And then finally you end up with some dead matter, which is just matter, which is not capable of any radiation in your system. Now quite a lot of it can be this, can turn into black holes. That means very large density matter, but very small in size. So the universe can, and then they can conglomerate, the universe can end up as one big black hole. That is one scenario that is thought of. The other scenario is that if the density, density which we don't know, is above a certain value, then it will go on expanding, then after some time, it will start contracting. When the universe starts contracting, all this what I told you, reverse, everything happens. That is, the temperature of the universe goes on increasing, increasing, increasing. You go back to almost the Big Bang. Then, the point is, that's one of the things, it might reverse. You see, you may think that that's called the oscillatory universe. That means it has happened that we started from some condition like that and we have come to this stage after 20 billion years. It will go on for maybe another 20 billion years or 30 billion years. Then it will start contracting and then go back to that stage and go on oscillating. That is the
point of return. Is governed by what?
Point is, today the measurements are not able to tell us, you see, what is the density of the, average density of the universe. So many of these things are in, there's a very crucial parameter there, that is the average density of the universe. That is, you take the total size of the universe and the total amount of matter inside and then find out what is the, one of the reasons why we don't know that also is because we can guess very accurately whatever is emitting some kind of radiation. That is what we call matter which is emitting radiations. We can see. But there could be a lot of dark matter. That means that it is not emitting radiation. It could be there, we won't see it. We can only see it by means of gravitational effects and things like that. But much of our knowledge about the universe is coming to us from the electromagnetic radiation. And if the body is very cold, it doesn't emit the type of radiation which we can detect. So how much of the universe contains this dark matter is uncertain. Then there are also other types of particles I didn't go into called the neutrinos. The content of the neutrinos also will decide the total amount of matter in the universe, and also whether the neutrino has even a small mass. See, that's a very important, in fact a lot of experiments are going on to check whether this neutrino, which is another particle which is extremely, very tricky particle. It doesn't interact with matter at all, but it seems to control many things in the universe, whether it has got even a very small mass.
But well, yes. You started the case that
you
have had an infinitely small
universe.
Yeah. With an infinitely small
density. Not infinite density, infinite density.
Infinite density. Infinite density.
That's called a singularity.
But the point is, beyond that, we are not able to go because these are the measurable terms. So do you go, I mean, as theoretical physicist or scientist, would you go from there to, okay, that's where the God started, because
we
don't know what the creation
is? That's why you can say G-O-K below that. I have written in my listing also, God only knows what happened before.
So what is the difference between these two? You said that the universe is one is that there will be one big matter,
yeah.
The other is the matter will collapse into itself and go back to that
singularity. Singularity can become very high, and again, you see, it might start off.
That one
Which one?
So the other option
is, you see, what happens is that all matter comes together, becomes one big black hole. Then there is a quantum mechanical effect. You see, normally a black hole is not supposed to radiate anything. It's supposed to be dead. But there are theories which tell you that even a black hole radiates, but at an extremely low rate. And as the black hole radiates, again, the time is, you know, enormously large. Slowly it becomes smaller and smaller mass. See, when you come to small mass black holes, they again start radiating. This is again, you know, what happens is, that is why this Einstein's ideas of space and time become extremely important, because black hole is a case where the neighborhood, because of the small size of the thing, infinite density. No, this I don't want to anymore, because I'll show the slides, it's already 1.5. Yeah, that's right. Exactly, exactly. In fact, he is the man who started this whole idea, because of quantum mechanical effects, even the black holes can radiate. Black holes are right.
But
Yeah, but you see, black hole will start exploding ultimately in a very short interval of time, according to Hawking. If, you know, that will take enormous amount of time. You may have an infinitely large size black hole, then it goes on radiating at a very low rate. And then, you see, as it, one of the consequences of Hawking's theory is, as the mass of the black hole becomes smaller and smaller, it radiates more and more. So when it becomes smaller size black hole, smaller mass black hole, it radiates, finally it will go into a kind of, it will explode. But there is a big theoretical difficulty there. You see, what you are left with after the explosion has a very difficult name called naked singularity, and one doesn't understand that. Oh, so let us start from... Can I change them? You just okay. In fact, let me start with this picture. This is just the Earth, which you see from a satellite. This is the view of the Earth taken from a satellite, because, you know, even this was a big controversial question, whether the Earth was flat or round or whatever it is. Nowadays, there can be no question about that. Next one. Yeah, you see, you know, it doesn't matter, since we have... Here you can see a particle coming in, and this is a lead plate in a cloud chamber. You can see this particle comes in, collides, and produces a large number of particles, kind of... this creation of particles by an incident single particle. And if you calculate how much time it takes to do that, as I said, it's an extremely small. So these are the first examples of actual creation of particles from high energy collisions. Next one. Yeah. This one is essentially a view of what we call the Milky Way galaxy. That is, if on a clear night, in a dark night, if you go out and see, you see a big band in the sky. Depending upon where you are in India, you can see it more beautifully. In fact, Bombay is a very good place to see it, kind of, and even Pune. In the night, you can see that this is what is called the Milky Way. And this is our galaxy. This is the galaxy in which we are there. These are all, of course, the different stars which belong to outside the galaxy. Can I have the next? Yeah, this shows you that these are all different, you know, you can see very large and very small ones. These large ones are different galaxies, and then the small ones are of course stars. And here you see that there is a very dark region. So there is a lot of matter between us and these galaxies. That shows, it's called the Orion region, where there is a lot of matter. That is why it is so dark there. There is so much matter that light from the other galaxies and stars are not reaching us. So in the telescopes you see, it's almost like a horse head here, if you see without lights. Then it's called the horse head nebula. So it is evidence for lot of matter being there in some regions. And now what is being done in this Orion region is to look for star formation, because it is in such areas where you have lot of matter, intergalactic space where you have lot of dust, that you expect the fluctuation to take place and suddenly collapsing of matter and formation of stars, etc. And the signature for formation of stars is to look for, in the early stages of a star formation, you get lot of infrared radiation. So nowadays there are special satellites with infrared detectors looking into this region to look for possible cases of formation of stars. Yeah, this is a very beautiful example of what is known as the Crab Nebula. Here in 1054 AD, this is a very interesting record by the Chinese astronomers. You know, the in 1054, in around that period, the Chinese were on the top of civilization in the world, and they had royal astronomers. And the job of the royal astronomers was to keep very accurate record of everything that they see in the sky. Of course, the reason that is given is they believed in astrology, but the astronomers, they were people who were making just observations and keeping very good records. So in this particular place, they saw what they called a guest star. That means on one night, one of the astronomers found a star in a place where there was no star. They called it the guest star. Then it turned out that later, you know, almost 900 years later, when people photographed that region, then they found this. It's a huge burning mass of gas, which is just a result of the explosion of that star. What they saw was the explosion of a star, but all they could see was a sudden brightening. That is why they called it a guest star. And that is what we call a supernova explosion now. And the envelope is the hot envelope that is still expanding because of the matter that is ejected out of the star when it collapsed. The more interesting thing is, in the last 20 years, at the center of this star, one has found evidence for this compact object, which is called a neutron star. One has been able to locate the neutron star. And the neutron star is essentially, you know, the leftover of the explosion. And then if the star had a magnetic field, then all the magnetic field also collapses. So it will be a region of intense magnetic field. And if you have intense magnetic field and particles, then it gives out special types of radiation called synchrotron radiation. So one had seen from this nebula, from this region, Crab Nebula, a lot of synchrotron radiation coming. Now one understands what is happening there. It is essentially the radiation that is produced in the neighborhood of the neutron star. Now the neutron star not only has got high magnetic field, but the momentum, angular momentum, it is spinning. So when it contracts, it starts spinning faster. So this particular object is now seen as what we call as a pulsar, and it is pulsating radiation. See, it goes on spinning like that, and every time one spot which comes towards you gives you a pulse of radiation. That pulse of radiation is seen in the X-rays, in the optical, in the camera rays, practically all over. So it has become an extreme. Next to the sun, the most interesting object in the sky is this Crab Nebula. And now they have gone back to the Chinese records, and those records have been extremely useful. because they have given a comparison of how the light intensity went down and compared to the compared to Venus, which was also seen around the same time. They have given the relative intensities of this star. So one knew before this 1987A, which we now have a good amount of data as to how the light decreases and things like that. Lot of useful data, even with just naked eye, they were able to give, because they were able to see this star during the day for something like 70 days or so after the explosion. And well, this of course is a little complicated, but you know, I started out by saying that in physics, according to physics today, we have basically four forces: the gravitational force, the electromagnetic force, then the strong force and the weak force. Now it turns out that a large amount of information that we have about the universe can be just understood in terms of gravitational force. That means the planets being held together, the galaxies being held together, and then they're all just consequences of, so gravity dominates over long distances compared to anything else. But then when you come to smaller and smaller dimensions, you find that these electromagnetic forces start dominating. And then when you go to still smaller dimensions, the nuclear dimensions, then the nuclear and these weak forces start dominating. And then finally, this is a very important development that has taken place. When you go to very high energies and extremely small distances, now the realization has come that all these forces are just different aspects of one and the same force. That is what we call the grand unification theory, according to which, so that is why here the ultra small and the very large, if you can read here, these are very large objects on this side, galaxies and stars and planets and moon, you see mountain, moon, then this is a planetary system, then a star, then a galaxy. These are very huge things. On this side we are going into the DNA molecules, and then the atoms, and then the nuclei, and the fundamental particles, and the supposed to show the tail of a snake going into the mouth, because now one has brought a relation between the macrocosmos and the microcosmos, because all the knowledge of these elementary particles is making us understand what is happening in these large scale phenomena. It's called the glass house snake. They have got a little mixed up, but anyway. See, this is how our own galaxy, this is not the picture of our galaxy because we can't get it being inside it, but this is the Andromeda galaxy. But from all observations, this is how our galaxy, these are all stars, individual stars. One galaxy is like this, and somewhere here is one star, that is our solar system. Well, this is another galaxy in which, you know, you got spiral structures. I mean, there are very different types of galaxies. These are all, you know, pictures taken with the 100-inch, 200-inch telescopes in the United States. Yes? Any question? Let's take him again with the 100-inch telescope, optical telescope.
You were saying that all ultimately is now one form of energy. Was that the one which you used to be working at
85 degrees?
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I think that is true
now. No, there are still difficulties. See, the point is, on this idea, quite a lot of progress has been made. But there are still problems, because one of the things that this grand unification theory predicts is that the proton, you know, which is the most, which is responsible for everything that is in the universe, that must also die. In fact, that's one of the experiments which we are trying to do in the collagen field. But so far, the death of the proton has not been established very unambiguously. So there are problems like that for the grand unification theory.
Quasar
is the name. Quasar stands for quasi-stellar radio sources. These are have got the maximum redshift. That means they are moving away from us. at very high velocity. Because of that, in this Hubble idea, they are the most distant objects. Okay. Then we know the amount of radiation that is coming to us from these objects in the form of radio, optical, X-ray and so on. And we know from the shift in the spectral lines what the distance is. If you put these two together, they become sources of tremendous amount of energy. The total amount of energy that is required from the quasar is, for example, the sun is producing something like 10 to the power of 33 eggs per second, but a quasar produces 10 to the power of 48 eggs per second. So one has, all these years, the quasars are first discovered as redshifted objects. That means enormous velocity and enormous power. Now they are being understood in terms of this possibility of black holes being there at the center of the quasar. And if you have a black hole, giant black hole, then matter can pour into the black hole. And that is one way of creating energy from the for radiation. And the quasars are thought to be, maybe they have giant black holes in their center.
You mentioned with Mutafis about the quasarism being one of the categories of the scientists assume, and you also made a remark that there is questioning about these categories. Could you please tell us?
No, that is connected with the fact that, as you go to smaller and smaller dimensions and higher energies, this is our classical idea phase. Then you enter into what is known as the quantum realm. So once you go into the quantum realm, you see we have problems of causality and then. Because you know, causality, what happens is when you come to, you cannot measure the time, delta t, the time interval in a certain, and at the same time, the energy. Okay. So you don't even know the sequence. You cannot be sure.
So it's only a question of not knowing the sequence that causes that causality.
Because you never know the sequence quantum mechanics.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, what do you mean by causality? See, normally what we understand by causality is that the cause precedes the effect. When that relation you cannot establish uniquely, then you are entering into difficulties.
Some Jedi's are taking this as liberty to even go away with causality at the macro level where we operate.
There is no justification for that.
That will cause terrible conditions. I think we should now stop even fighting. I can see Dr. Srikanth getting tired too.
No,
but if you have any more questions, you're welcome.
Just wanted to ask one more.
Yes, sure.
The Americans had brought some rocks up from the moon. Have they told us what elements are there?
Yes, that has been analyzed. See, the elements are, in fact, our own people have analyzed it also. Professor Lal from our own laboratory at TIFR, who later went to, he has analyzed it. Only surprise was that, normally we think that because we call a girl who is beautiful Indumukhi, that is, she has a fair complexion. But in truth, the lunar surface is all black. Because the magnesium oxides and things like that dominate. There is a certain difference in the slight chemical composition, but basically there is no.
Only no, the sun is shining.
Is there any life on any part of the universe?
Pardon?
Is there any life?
Yeah, you raised a very important question. We don't know the answer still. But the argument goes like this, that as I have impressed you with all those numbers. How many stars are there, how many galaxies are there and so on. Now, and we are part of the solar system, one planet belonging to one star. So why should the conditions be only suitable on just one star, one planet out of one star for life, when so many stars and so many planetary systems could be there? So if you put in probability argument, there is no reason why there should not be any number of civilizations outside. But
there are some arguments which go like this, that if a civilization exists elsewhere, why are they not contacting us, or why we are not getting any response? There is no chance of our reaching any other civilization because of the distances. It's just impossible in 100 years or 200 years or 500 years to reach even with the velocity of light, because spacing between one object and another is so large that there is no question of going to places where and in search of civilization. So we have to depend only on signals that can be coming from there. And even that, the time taken, if I send a message today, which people have done, there are projects in which they are trying to contact other civilizations by sending in some radio signals in a coded fashion. Because even there, you have to find out how they will understand us, because they will have developed an entirely different way. So we have to establish some way in which they will understand the message that we give. And there, you know, after the discovery of pulsars, it has been possible to work out some method by which you can make it known to them who you are and where you are. Some kind of information can be sent to them. Okay. Now, that takes, in fact, if you take the nearest star, it is about 4.3 light years. That means, for the message to come back, even if it goes at the velocity of light, it takes 8 years. But we know that there is nothing in our neighborhood, because if it was there, we would have. But it will take 200, 300, 500 years from any possible civilization to get a message back. But against this, the argument is that our civilization, though technological civilization, is only about 200 or 300 years. If civilizations have been there, life had evolved in the way it has evolved here, and they also became civilized, then the chances of their being much more advanced is much higher than us. They will be in a much more advanced stage, because 300 years is nothing compared to the millions and millions of years that we are talking about. So this, just the statistical argument tells us that if there are civilizations, that they would be in a much more advanced stage, and they may not be interested in contact.
But is it not true that no fossils have been observed in Mars or anything like that? So that even life didn't start in some of the other planets.
That's still a mystery.
So that the probability is affected in some way. Well, could be. That would be a strange animal. Well, gentlemen, I must thank Professor Srikanthan for what I call the widest spectrum lecture I have ever heard. First of all, he had the widest spectrum audience, starting from very different professions, some of them engineers, some of them scientists, and you spoke of such a wide vista of things. I didn't know it was possible even, but you have achieved the almost impossible. So we are all very grateful to you very much for coming, spending the time with us, and taking so much trouble to explain such complex and difficult details of creation, and in such a short period of time, and answering that question.